Hello, gorgeous community of beautiful, brassy people. I hope y'all are having a swell day. If not, I promise it's about to get a lot better. Before we get started, I just want to say thank you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for taking me along with you on your workout or your commute or your walk with the dog. I would love to know who you would like to hear interviewed on the show or any specific music industry related topics that you'd like to hear discussed. Leave a comment on the Brassy Broadcast Facebook page or email me at Jen, J-E-N, at brassybroad.com. Now, before we jump into the conversation this week, I want to share a little bit about this book I read recently called The Miracle Morning by Hal Elrod. It has been a total game changer for me. I've committed to doing a 30-day Miracle Morning Challenge. So as of today, this recording, I am 17 days in a row into this challenge. And the most notable results have been that my productivity and my thirst to take on new challenges has just exploded through the roof. So as part of this challenge, I've committed to 30 minutes of focused guitar practice every morning, like at 7 a.m. So it's been coffee and guitar before I start my work day. And I'm sure my bandmates are really grateful that I'm practicing a little more. But the reason I bring up the practicing for 30 minutes a day is because I had this little annoying voice in my head telling me, well, since you love playing guitar, it doesn't really work. So it doesn't need to be a priority. And that is so wrong. Fortunately, I do get paid to play guitar, but even if I didn't and I didn't consider it a job, I call myself a guitar player and I'm passionate about playing. So therefore, I am committing to working on my craft every day. So if you have that same little stupid voice in your head telling you lies about something that you love, tell it to take a hike and practice. Just try it 30 minutes a day for 30 days. Let me know how it goes. I'm already seeing insane amounts of improvement in my playing, and I'm pretty excited about that. Okay, enough with the PSA announcement for this episode. Now back to our regularly scheduled awesomeness. And y'all are in for a big treat today. Why, you ask? Well, because today I'm chatting with a guest that I will not even try to define by saying she is blah, 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 fill in the blank. I'm just going to say that her name is Cher Ross, and she does lots of cool things. So she can call herself the bass player and vixen, an author, and the rock and roll life coach. And just a little side note, when I was in high school, I had one of those tear-up posters of Vixen on my wall of my practice room. You know, the ones that you'd get in Circus or Hit Parade or Magazine. So you can imagine I was just a little bit excited to have this conversation. Now, when you think of a rock star from the decadent 80s, the last thing you would expect is an outrageously positive personality. Cher Ross loves to give you the unexpected. As the rock and roll life coach, she inspires her clients to take a quantum leap in their lives and businesses while she's still out playing gigs to thousands of rock fans. She's best known as the bassist in the platinum-selling all-female 80s rock band Vixen, and she plays dates all over the globe with Ozzy Osbourne, Kiss, Bon Jovi, Deep Purple, The Scorpions, and more. She also plays bass for Joe Elliott's side project, The Down and Outs. For those of you that don't know, Joe is the lead singer for another little band you might have heard of, Def Leppard. So Cher's a busy gal. And she surprised rock fans when she took up knitting and 2 years later published a knitting book, Punk Knits, with a major publisher. Cher believes in creating your own luck. She never let two bankruptcies, divorce, or a myriad of unsuccessful business ideas stop her. She's a walking testament that you gotta live in the now and let your inner rock star guide you towards your true path. All right. Let's rock and roll with Cher Ross.
My mom was a musician. So the first time I have a conscious memory was playing piano when I was 4 years old.
You started early.
She was a piano teacher as well.
That's convenient.
Yeah. It was like built in, you know, just like totally built in the family. And so she had six brothers and sisters who were all musicians, and her parents were musicians as well. So every time they came over, it was just like this amazing music that would happen. So that definitely informed me as well and influenced me. I was like, oh, music is fun. Music is family. Music is, you know, joy, all that kind of stuff.
When did you branch out beyond piano?
Pretty early on, actually. I kept playing piano for years and years and years, but I think I tried violin when I was seven, and then I played that for a couple of years, and then I got bored of that. I think the teacher made me cry.
Oh, no.
I know. Heaven forbid. And so I was like, that's it. I don't want to play violin anymore.
Uh-huh.
Oh, geez. Anyway, so then, yeah, I tried a few things. You know, I think I tried my hand at a saxophone here and there and tried to play guitar. And I had a cousin, again, the super musical family thing, on my mom's side, who was a phenomenal bass player. And my mom actually played upright bass as well. She got really into that, too.
That's
so
cool.
I know. My mom was like super hip. So I heard that bass stuff a lot. And I was obsessed with, you know, Led Zeppelin and Aerosmith and the Rolling Stones. And I was looking at all of them going, well, I want to be one of the people in the band. So
yeah.
I'm thinking bass.
That's so cool.
Because it was like, in my mind, it was like, oh, not cool to be the keyboard player. Just not cool. And so that was it. I was just like, the bass is cool. And I always, when I played a lot of duets with my mom on piano, you know, like the four hand thing.
Uh-huh.
And I would always want to play the bass part. I was always like, oh, let me be the bass. Let me be the bass.
You were meant to be a bass player, weren't you?
Oh, it totally was. I just like gravitated to it, you know. So I finally got a bass when I was 15, and my parents were so fed up with me bouncing around on instruments. They just bought me the cheapest bass humanly possible from like the Sears store.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it was like, I don't know how much it was back then. I don't know. It was a long time ago, $25 or something. You know? It was like this no-name brand. You couldn't differentiate one note from another. But, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
I had to start somewhere. So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then did you start playing upright as well?
Not until later. I did try my hand at upright. And I'm going to tell you, I pretty much sucked at it. I was not a natural at playing the upright bass by a mile. I thought it was really hard, just physically and everything else. And I was just so into laying it down with bass that I was like, what I could hear in my head, I just couldn't get right on the upright bass. So I did do a few gigs as like a jazz. I mean, I did a lot of jazz gigs back mm-hmm. then, but I would use my fretless bass. And then a couple people were like, oh, why don't you bring your upright? So I'd bring my upright a couple times and it was just awful. It was like humiliatingly bad. So I was that's not really working. So I held on to it and I kept trying to get better. But that was actually the one of the biggest things that I sold to move to LA. That funded my move to LA when I was 21.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, okay, I'm selling this and I'm going to rock and roll.
Good for you. And well, and what got you into jazz?
I think it was mostly like growing up with that music that my mom would play a lot and then my cousins and stuff. I kind of heard it a little bit, but I think the real trigger was I was the bass player for like a singing group at my school,
mm-hmm.
which was a disappointment because I wanted to be one of the singers, but I wasn't good enough. So they put me on bass instead. But, you know, rejection has a way of leading you down the path you're meant to be on.
It sure does.
So Mr. McKay was like, no, why don't you just play bass for us instead, Cher? I was like, okay. Came home in tears that day. But anyway, so I was the bass player for the Now and Then Singers. And there was a lot of pieces that we would do that would be really jazzy. And I would have all these walking bass parts, which were not given to me as chords. They were given to me as notes. So I had to like read all the notes. And talk about a nightmare. So one day he kind of pulled me aside and he was like, you know, you're really good at this jazz stuff. And he gave me his copy of Downbeat magazine, which in that day anyway, was like pretty much it if you were a jazz musician. Like that was the end all be all. It was like the Godhead magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And he pointed to this ad and he goes, there's this school called Berklee College of Music, and they have a summer session. And I think you ought to talk to your parents and consider going there for the summer, because I think, you know, you'd really learn a lot from it. And I was like, well, what? Berklee? What? Huh? What is all? You know, I was just totally never heard of it, totally clueless. So, you know, came home, pored over the ad. There was no internet. I couldn't go research it. So I'm just like reading. I think I memorized the ad and just begged and begged and begged my parents. And they relented and sent me there for that summer. I think it was the summer before my senior year.
Oh, wow. So what did you get out of that experience?
A lot of jazz. Oh, man. No, a ton. I mean, totally like got into the jazz thing big time. Sold what, I don't remember which bass I had at that time. Oh, I do actually. And I still am mad at myself for selling it, but you just don't know then. So right. I had this awesome Rickenbacker bass. I know, right? Gas.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I sold it to buy a fretless bass from somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, whatever. Anyway. So I switched over to fretless, and it was at Berklee. I was introduced to Jaco Pastorius and Miles Davis and all this kind of stuff. And I was just like, whoa, where have I been? I mean, my brain, just, I think it exploded.
Oh, I'm sure.
And then the other thing that was really interesting was, and I'm sure you'll relate to this, was all through school, I had always felt a little bit like I didn't really belong. And I didn't, you know, I don't know. I just sort of felt like nobody really got me. And kind of like an outsider, and you know, I was pretty athletic, so I was in a lot of athletic, you know, sporty things as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it was sort of like I was kind of going, yeah, this is great, with a kind of a fake smile on my face, woo ha, yay, cool, right. Whatever, you know. And I was, but it's like I just wasn't there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And at Berklee, oh my God, total sense of belonging.
You found your people.
I found my people. My people found me. So I was just like, this is awesome. And like, and that just blew me away. So when the summer ended and I went back to school, oh, dude, major depression.
Oh, yeah.
I started flunking every class, was not interested. I was just like, that's it. I've had a taste.
Mm-hmm.
It's like somebody gave me heroin, basically.
Yeah.
And I was just like, you know, forget everything else. I'm done. And so I dropped out of school. My parents were like, well, if you're not going to school, you got to get a job, you know? So
right.
I started playing bass for stupid, you know, they pay me like $5 a gig or something to play some play or something. I don't know. It was terrible. But eventually I went on the road the day I turned 18.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So is that when you went out to LA?
Oh God, no.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Oh no. No, I cut my teeth on, first I went on the road with like a cover band just to make money. And then eventually I started, you know, finding other bands in Minneapolis and started auditioning for all the jazz groups. And so I became like the kind of a go-to jazz bass player in Minneapolis. I was like called on for all sorts of sessions and just crazy stuff. Yeah, it was awesome. And talk about, like, I was always the youngest. I was always the greenest, you know what I mean? But yeah. I was willing and ready and totally okay with making a complete ass of myself, like the aforementioned upright bass experience. Like, yeah, sure, I'll embarrass myself. I don't care. You know, I just would just say yes was my motto. Just say yes.
Yeah, you know? You can figure it out later.
Yeah. Like I remember like this huge Latin 22-piece band asked me to play bass for them. And I was like, I'm from Lakeville. Like,
right.
I don't know if I can play that, you know? And they're like, oh, you'll be fine. And, you know, like the bass never hits the one.
Yeah.
It's always on all these upbeats and stuff. And I was just like, whoa, I was completely out of my depth. And I remember after the gig, they're going, yeah, you did really good. And I was like, well, you might think I did really good, but I just lost 15 pounds from sweating.
Right.
You know, I was so nervous and terrified. So, I mean, I would just say yes to whatever.
How did playing gigs like that influence your, you know, what you did with Vixen and playing rock in general?
It really gave me confidence. You know, that thing of having to fly by the seat of your pants, don't stop playing, no matter how badly you totally go to the worst notes humanly possible. Uh-huh. Don't stop playing. Because you know what it's like. If the bass player stops, it's like,
yeah.
Oh, what happened?
Yeah, it's like the whole bottom just falls out.
Yeah, bass players and drummers cannot stop. You just don't. It's like, I don't care. Just keep going. You'll You'll find it. You'll find the one. You'll find the root, whatever it is that you lost, you know. Yeah. And so to this day, you know, the other week we were playing some Vixen gig and I don't know. My brain had a brain fart and I couldn't hear something and mm-hmm. somebody played something weird. And all of a sudden you're second guessing and you're going, wait, did we already,
yeah.
Are we on the bridge? Wait, what? And but that's going through my brain, but my fingers just keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. You know?
And eventually I was like, oh, there it is. All right, we got it.
Yes. And you're magically back in the groove.
Yes. And there we are. We've located the root one more time. Map to the root. The map to the root is always to just keep playing. You'll find the right note eventually.
Exactly.
That definitely informed me, you know, on that. And really the biggest part was it expanded my hearing. I was in so many situations where there was no chart, there was nothing, and you just had to fly by the seat of your pants and play, you know, four sets, five sets.
Mm-hmm.
And just listen.
Yeah. You'll find it.
You'll figure it out. I was like, oh, okay, great. So a lot of times if there was a piano player, I'd go stand next to them and look at their left hand and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, you definitely learn the tricks, don't you?
Oh, totally. I'd be like, what's the first chord? What's that? What's the starting chord? So at least I could start like I knew what I was doing, you know?
Right.
So yeah, so just a lot of flying by the seat of my pants. And like I said, be willing to make an ass of yourself, because chances are, you'll know that you have, but some other people might not, and you'll grow from it. So it's all good.
Absolutely. I think that is wonderful advice.
It totally is. I've done so many gigs where I've made a complete, well, in my mind, I was just like, wow, okay, that was embarrassing. But, you know.
And nobody has a clue. Fun.
No, absolutely. They don't even know. They literally don't know. And, you know, like after Vixen, my husband and I had this other band, we still have it, called Bubble. And, I'm the guitar player in that band. Now, most people play guitar and then they learn to play bass.
Mm-hmm.
But I went pretty much from piano to bass. So to me, guitar was like this alien thing with bizarre tuning
mm-hmm.
and all these really complicated positions to put my left hand into. And I was just like, this is awkward. So we had this friend of ours who showed us open blues tuning.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wrote all these songs in that tuning. And we had always thought, up until that point, we'd always had a guitar player and I was the bass player. So I'd be like, here's the songs, you play it now in real tuning and I'll play bass. Well, this opportunity came up and this guy, this club owner called up and said, hey, you know, we've got this club and we really need a band to come in like Tuesday night. And this was Sunday. And my husband says, yeah, we'll do it. And he hangs up the phone. He looks at me. He goes, okay, we got a gig in 2 days. And I'm like, what? Excuse me? And he's like, yeah, it's just going to be you and me. You're going to play guitar.
Oh, wow.
And I was completely panicked. So that was it, though. We went up on stage that night. That was our first gig as Bubble, as a two-piece band, long before it was hip to be a two-piece band or whatever. We were just desperate. It was right? Just like, well, okay, whatever. This is all we got, you know? Who cares? And I was... I think I was shaking in my shoes, literally. But it came back to that being willing to make an ass of myself. And I just went with it. And the club owner came over at the end of the night and said, you guys are awesome. We want you to be the house band. And we were like, are you kidding? And they said, no, we're serious. And we were the house band. It was this club called Goldfingers in Hollywood. We were the house band there for like, I don't know, a year.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. It was amazing. It launched like this whole glam rock resurgence, punk, like kind of a punk pop glam rock scene. Of course, I didn't call myself Cher Ross at that point. I was Bunny Vicious.
I love it.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Bunny. Hello, it's Bunny. So yeah, I think the whole process of just being willing to make an ass of yourself is kind of an important piece of getting up on stage. Because let's face it, if you think you're going to be perfect at every gig, you are not going to have fun.
No. And once I got over that, I was like, okay. Like it got a whole lot more fun to go out and play.
Yeah. What's the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to you on stage?
Let's see. I forgot the intro to a song. We were playing this huge gig and I was a lead guitar player and like it didn't come. Then finally it came.
Oh
It was the worst. Like, I mean, because there were probably like 1,000 people, which for us was a big gig.
Yeah, that's a huge gig.
And I'm like, oh my God, I just completely blanked. So the singer was kind of giving me a little grief, like just in good fun. And at the end of the night, this girl came up and she's like, I can't believe she was so mean to you. I'm like, no, she was kidding. She was kidding. It was great.
Oh, that's great.
And I'm thinking, man, she had every right. She could have been so mean to me, but...
That's awesome.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't know. I guess I appeared helpless and endearing for a minute, so... So I knew that I had one fan.
Little did they know that you are a brassy broad.
Exactly. So, but you know what? I recovered, and it was fine, and we played the gig, and all was good. So it's like, yeah. You know, what's the worst thing that's going to happen? Nothing, really.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But yeah, we all have those nights.
Oh, man. I'll totally. Totally.
So tell me about the move to LA.
That came about just... I don't know. I'd kind of reached a point in the Minneapolis St. Paul scene where I thought, okay, it's going to go down like this. I'm either going to end up in Prince's band, which all of my friends were.
Oh, nice.
Or I need to leave.
Uh-huh.
I was like, the only way up is to join the Prince company.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, you know, I really don't like snow.
That's a good reason to leave the Midwest.
Yeah, and that was pretty much it. You know, I set a plan. I mean, there's a whole bigger backstory that involves a hurricane and the Bermuda Triangle and all this other stuff, but it's a really long story. So that, the hurricane and the Bermuda Triangle on a 52-foot yacht, and I thought I was going to die. And so I went, okay, what do I really want to do with my life? I was like, oh, I really want to move to LA. So that was kind of what gave me the realization that this is it.
Mm-hmm.
This is it. Quit talking, start walking.
So what'd you do when you got there?
My first day, I went down to the Musicians Union to hang out and meet people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Got my car towed and ended
welcome.
Up, I know, welcome to LA. Got my car out and ended up going to a drag show on Santa Monica Boulevard. That was my first day in LA.
That's a really good day. I mean, other than the car towing thing.
It was all pretty momentous. Yeah, it was pretty insane. And but then, you know, from what my path was I've always been fairly resourceful. So when there was no interweb, I had to network. And so before I moved to LA, I asked every single person I knew in Minneapolis, whether they were a musician or not. I'm like, who do you know in LA who's in the music business or connected to it in any way, shape, or form? Can I drop your name? Can you give me their phone number? And so I had this notebook of names and phone numbers and who it was that knew them. And I just sat there. I knew one person in LA who gave me like a bedroom to sleep in. And I had a little exercise mat. That was my bed.
Oh, wow.
And then, you know, the phone's in the wall. And I was like, can I use the phone for an hour? So I just sat there on their phone with my notebook of names. And I would just sit there and call people and set up meetings. And eventually that led to, you know, auditions. And I got in a top 40 band to pay the bills because you got to eat. Rule number one, got to eat. And then, I don't know, things just sort of, you know, mosey along. And I was in a few bands here and there. And then, you know, it's just like any scene, you start meeting people. And eventually I started auditioning for a lot of different situations and ended up getting a starring role in a McDonald's commercial as the bass player, but it was the starring role. So that was nice. I was like, awesome, good money, great experience, super
fun.
When
does the bass player ever get to be the star?
I know, right?
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
That was crazy, huh? I know, that was really weird. So that was cool. And then, I don't know, I just did a lot of cattle call auditions, you know, where it's just like everybody and their uncles lined up mm-hmm. around the block. And one of those ended up being for Helen Reddy, the Australian pop singer.
Cool.
And they put me through my paces and amazingly enough, they called me back and then I got the gig.
Nice.
So yeah, so that was awesome. That was like, oh, hello, steady money, good gig. And so I traveled around, we went all over the place with her and it was... You know, it wasn't like you went on tour. It was just, you know, you fly off and go play a show and then you fly home.
Yeah.
So I was still doing other bands and stuff. So I was on call for a lot of bands as their go-to bass player, as a gun for hire.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in one of those situations at a club in Hollywood. It was a rock band, but they paid me to learn all their songs and show up and play it like I was in the band. And but I was getting tired of all that. And this chick came up to me after that gig, this one, I can't remember the guy's name. And she was just like, hey, you know, you're really cool. My name's Jan and I have this band called Vixen. And, you know, here's my number if you ever want to connect, if you ever want to hang out. And I was like, okay, yeah, that's cool. And I took the number. It was on a bar napkin, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Shoved it into my bag and promptly forgot about it because I was like, oh, girl band, that's so funny. I was so not interested and just so like up in my own space. And a few months went along and there's the main magazine in LA was the Music Connection. And I started looking through it with the realization I needed to find a band. I was tired of being a gun for hire and that's not what I got into the music business for. So there was this review of this local band called Vixen and it was like, oh, these chicks are actually really good and blah, 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 blah. Nah, 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 nah. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And then I thought, oh, I have that chick's phone number. And I thought, maybe I can call her, find out where they're playing, go and see them, and then that'll introduce me to this other scene, and she can introduce me to other people who might need a bass player.
Yeah.
That was my intention. Picked up the phone, dialed her number, chatted for about 5 minutes, and then she said, did you hear a rumor about the band? And no, I didn't hear any rumor about Vixen. She says, well, it's just really weird that you called today. And I'm like, okay. She carries on. She's like, we just fired our bass player 30 minutes ago.
Oh my gosh.
I know, right? And she's like, there's no way you could have known that, right? And I'm like, no, I did not know that.
Wow.
So it was literally like divine timing or whatever. And, you know, I went to the audition, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then they were like, do you want to be in the band? And I was like, yeah. And, yeah. And then it, you know, it took us a while and I don't know, a number of months. It wasn't a year. Definitely wasn't a year. And then we had the record deal with EMI.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history, as they say.
So if the music thing hadn't worked out and you had a backup plan, which it kind of based on, you know, all of the research that I've done, you have like all these backup plans. Well, that I think most people would call backup plans. And you're doing all this other stuff while you're totally being in this kick-ass rock and roll band. So tell us a little bit about some of the other irons that you have in the fire. And my God, woman, how do you prioritize and do so many things?
That's a really good question. Okay. Yeah. Okay. First, the prioritizing question. I have whiteboards next to me that I write on all the time. And I also use a thing in my Chrome browser now called Momentum Dash that lets me put in a to-do list so I can know what it is I need to do. Cause I'll think of it, add it in there and then forget about it.
Okay, cool. That's so good to know about.
Yeah. Momentum Dash, totally free. Works awesome. And it's beautiful. Cool. It's just beautiful, beautiful photography. Okay. So the other stuff, a lot of stuff came up as like, I don't know. It's that same thing of like, just dive in, be willing to make a complete ass of myself and have fun with it. And then some of it is just like my dad always had this thing with me where he would ask me, you know, like, okay, that's cool that you're into that. Is that something you can make money from? Can you turn that into a business?
Mm-hmm.
So he sort of ingrained this whole entrepreneurial thinking in me from like a really young age.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. He was just always like, well, that's really interesting that you're doing that. Can that be a business? And I'd be like, well, I don't know, Dad. You know, like at one point, you know, we had our band Bubble and our guitar player's girlfriend was the web designer. Guitar player quits the band. Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
No more website.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, we better learn how to build a website. So we learn how to build our own website. And then people start coming to you. Hey, we saw the website that you built for your band. Can we get a website too? Blah, blah, blah. So suddenly you've got a web design business. We did that for a number of years. So just crazy stuff like that of just diving in, doing what you have to do and never having the attitude of like, why do I have to do this?
Mm-hmm.
That's a question I really work hard to not ask myself. why do I have to be the one to do it? It's like, well, you know what? I'm capable of doing it. I think the more important question now, you know, as you get busier and busier, is what do you need to delegate?
Mm-hmm.
Am I answering your question?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I mean, what would I do if I had a backup plan? Dude, anything. Web design, write copy. It's like, especially now, you can go on YouTube, you can learn anything. There's free coding websites. We can learn to write JavaScript for free. You can, I mean, my God, what, I could think of 100 things that I could do. My problem is wanting to do all of them.
Yeah, yeah.
I just don't like to be bored. I think it's all about being, you know, loving the feeling of being productive and then valuing yourself, valuing your time, and realizing that expressing yourself in any way is not better or worse than the experience of playing music on stage. A lot of people think, well, once you've played music on stage, you know, and played in front of X number of people, how could you possibly ever do anything else? Well, that's one experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get an immense amount of pleasure, you know, giving a keynote speech in front of a room of, you know, 200 people. That's like crazy rewarding.
Oh, definitely.
It's a different kind of rewarding, mm-hmm. but it's still crazy rewarding. So I think the biggest shift for me around all of that stuff was I had a friend when I was about 30-ish, don't remember the age, who wanted, he was a shiatsu teacher, shiatsu massage teacher, and he was mm-hmm. a yogi and really into meditation and everything. And he was offering this course to become a certified shiatsu massage therapist. And I was really interested in it. And I said, you know, I want to do this, but, and he's like, what's the but? And I was like, well, you know, I'm a musician. I don't know. It's kind of weird. And he was like, whoa, 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 stop there. And he goes, first of all, whatever you say after I am is going to limit you. He goes, just stop finishing the sentence of I am. He goes, he just like set me aside. He was like, Cher, you're not a musician. It doesn't define you. You play music. You play the bass. You are. He goes, stop limiting yourself. Stop finishing that sentence. And so I was like, oh, wow, that's freaky. Which is the basis for Joel Osteen's, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he has a book and all sorts of stuff out about, you know, I am.
Mm-hmm.
And that, but that, I really took it to heart. And I started jogging up and down this mountain. I was really into running at that time. And my mantra was just, I am. And so I went on to become a certified shiatsu therapist and got, that became a business.
Yeah.
I got a lot of clients from that. So that's the thing that I always come back to, is like not letting what you do define who you are. And then once you step into that and you keep owning it, and believe me, it's an evolution. You got to keep owning it over and over and over again. It opens up the path to like, hey, you know what? If I want to do this thing, I can.
Yeah, that's huge. That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. There's actually a book around the language of that, which I've never read, so I can't say whether it's good or bad or whatever, but it's called E Prime. Like okay. The letter E and then the word prime, because, and it's a whole way of trying to write and speak and everything. But I just got so frustrated with trying to do that, I gave up. But if anybody really wants to get into it, you can check that out. Or you can check out the Joel Osteen thing. I think he's got a lot of publications on that.
Cool. I will have links to those.
Cool.
All right. So tell us about the coaching. What pulled you into that?
The coaching. Yeah, that kind of happened organically, really. I had been doing the video stuff, which we didn't really get into that, which was a whole other world.
Uh-huh.
That just started off organically as well. And then that grew into, I was hosting this video show where we were showing bands in Hollywood to the world. And then that led to being a video producer and editor and all this other stuff for all these big record labels. And then that led to me having my own course for entrepreneurs. And it was in the process of running that course that people would graduate from the video thing and then they'd want to work with me as their coach. And so that's how that kind of happened, was it just people kept coming to me and asking me about stuff. And so I started to realize Because the whole video thing that I teach, there's a lot, it's a lot of inner work. You know, there's a little bit of technical, but really how you show up on camera is a lot to do with what's going on inside. So when you go through that work, that's where that's when you really start shining on camera. But then there's a whole bunch of more stuff that you can do, you know, mindset stuff and then of course learning marketing and blah, 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 and all this other stuff that helps you, whether you're a musician, an artist, a writer, entrepreneur, whatever. It all ties together, and how you show up in your life is going to be very closely reflected to how you show up in your business.
Absolutely.
And so all that stuff just kind of, I don't know, just kind of happened organically. And, you know, it's funny because it was really only this year, 2015, that I really finally started to own that I am a coach. I coach people. I'm doing the I am thing. That I coach people. Let's say that. And one of the things that comes up with the I am is, well, how do you introduce yourself? So I call myself the rock and roll life coach. It's a different statement than I am the rock and roll life coach. I call myself the rock and roll life coach because I love to bring in that branding, obviously. And I'm a really casual person. You know, I'm not all like, okay, this is the path that I'm going to do. And this is my blueprint. And this is my formula. When I coach people, it's very individualized. It's very, very customized. You know, I've coached one person who was really stuck on finishing a book. She had graduated, you know, some fancy college for writing people. I don't freaking know. I'm not big into degrees. I think if they help you, great, but don't cling to it.
Mm-hmm.
And all of her friends were getting books published and she couldn't finish a book. So during the course of our work together, now she's finished 3 books and she's, you know, she's in the process of sending out the query letters for the first one, which she's really, really happy with, and doing the drafts for the next 2. So that's like one scenario. And I have another type of client who, you know, we only had, some people I work with, you know, for 3 months at a time. Other people, it's just like a VIP thing. We just like cram it.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy did a cram session. And after that session, it kicked his ass so hard that he finally launched into action. And he wrote to me. We stayed in touch, of course. He wrote to me a year later. He was like, I have to tell you, Cher, I started the business that I talked about on the phone with you. And he closed out the year with a $300,000 profit.
Wow.
Profit.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. So, you know, it's really, that's why I say it's not a blueprint. It's not a formula. It's like, it depends on what the person needs. And I just apply all this stuff that I'm crazy into all the personal development stuff. So I just reflect back and listen. And then I hold people crazy accountable.
For me, that's the biggest thing. I need, I don't know why, but it's like stuff doesn't get done. If there's not a deadline and there's not somebody holding me to it, it's like, I can put that off.
Yeah.
Why is that? Why are we like that?
A lot of it's stories we tell ourselves. A lot of it's facing those fears of success/failure. You know, if you do it, what would happen if you really succeed? If you do that thing, what would happen if you don't get the results that you dream about getting? You know, there's a lot of stuff that goes through our minds. And so it's the easiest thing is to stay comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
It's the easiest path to take. Just don't challenge yourself. Stay comfortable. Don't get uncomfortable. Do what you've always done. And then at the end of the day, you're like, shit, I wish I would have blank, 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 you know?
Yeah, exactly. So the other thing that I wanted to talk about, because I was just like, wow, who would have thunk it? The knitting book.
I knew you were going to go there.
And I looked at it. And I was like, well, that stuff's really cool.
Oh, thank you.
So how did that happen?
Oh, God, that's funny. That was when at that time I was an online travel agent. Another one of my things I was doing. Now, that was not an entrepreneurial thing, but I did work for a company. And so I was really busy with that, and it was a lot of being on the phone, and I needed something to relax with that wasn't music. And a friend of mine came over in LA, and she was wearing a scarf that she had knitted. And now you got to understand, My family was musicians. There was not a crafty person there. Like, no knitting, no crocheting. There was some sewing, but that was it. And I couldn't sew worth it. Jeez, forget it. I mean, it's like if something's ripped, oh, well, throw it away. Give it to Goodwill, whatever. Yeah. It's done. It's over. So the whole knitting thing was really alien to me. And she walked in. I was like, that scarf is awesome. I have, oh my God, where did you get that? And she was like, I made it. And I was like, you what? I mean, it was just like this whole world opened up to me. And she was like, I knitted it. And I was like, what's knitting? Is that the thing with the two sticks or the one stick? I didn't know the difference.
Oh, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, I mean, I just was so clueless. Now, at this point, I was really afraid of making an ass of myself. Like, I was afraid of the knitting stores in LA. I don't know if you've been to a yarn store in Los Angeles, but they can be really uppity.
Really?
Yes. Now, not all of them. Not all of them. But a lot of them are really, it's very cliquish.
Huh.
And so I was a little bit afraid to go to one. And so I just went online and I ordered like an eBay knit a scarf kit. And I just sat there at my computer watching videos online until I could figure it out. I think I had to unravel it 3 times. I mean, the first scarf that I knitted was so bad.
Oh, no.
Drop stitches and added stitches, you know, like the side of it went in and out and then that was all uneven and horrible. I wish I still had it because it would be great. But that was the beginning of it. But the funny thing was, it was just that process of doing this thing that I found really, really relaxing. And it was something that I needed after the pressure of being a travel agent all day long, like, you know, hours and hours and hours on the phone. Mm-hmm. And so it was really just like, oh, this is so nice. And so I got really into it. And then, as you do, I started blogging about my knitting.
Right.
And extensively blogging about my knitting and then buying every knitting book that was known to mankind and getting like really, really into it. And so the author of this big knitting book, Deb Stoller, she was the author of Stitch and Bitch.
Nice. That's awesome.
I know. Great book. Phenomenal knitting book. So cool. And I loved that book to like death. I mean, I was just like, oh my God, this is the best book ever. And she read my blog and she was like, I would love for you to contribute a pattern to my next book. And I was like, are you kidding me? What? Me? Like, I've been knitting for like a year and a half. You must be insane. And I had posted this badly photoshopped image of a sweater that I wanted to knit for my husband that was based on a scarf that I'd knit. Mm-hmm. Super holy, super kind of punky, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the owner of the French owner of the snobbiest yarn store in LA, like when I bought the yarn for that, she was like, oh, you must not knit these yarns together. I can't do her accent. She was like, you know, I was like, you must not knit this together. This will not work. You know, you cannot knit these yarns together. I was like, yeah, but it's punky. She was like, it is what? You know what I mean? She was just like, you know, she had the glasses down the nose. She was like literally looking down her nose at me.
Oh, no.
So I never went there again.
Yeah.
It's horrible. But anyway, so.
It's like Pretty Woman of knitting.
It was. I was like the street walking prostitute. And she was like the Beverly Hills store. Full on. And I was like, I'm going to have a book one day and you're going to regret that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So yeah. So one thing led to another. The BAM 13 sweater went into the Stitch and Bitch Nation book. And then I started meeting other people. I met the owner of a really cool knitting store and she really encouraged me and got me designing and blah, 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 and all this stuff. And one day I was talking to her saying, how come, you know, I said, Stitch and Bitch is cool, but I'd still like to see a book that has models that are, you know, maybe have some tattoos, maybe have some piercings, mm-hmm. you know, a little bit more rock and roll. And she's like, that's going to be your book.
Yeah.
And so it was really her. She really pushed me. And then she introduced me to a book agent who then introduced me to this world of doing a knitting book proposal. And it happened really fast. And before I knew it, the biggest craft book publishers contacted me and said, we love this idea. And my editor was this woman named Melanie, and she is to this day my favorite knitting editor. It's like having a record producer that you love. So it all worked out. And then we got all of our friends in Hollywood to be the models and stuff. Roy Mayorga is in there. Some of you might know him from Stone Sour.
Cool.
He's also in another band, which, of course, I can't think of right now. He's like a really big metal drummer. He's in the book. Calico Cooper, the daughter of Alice Cooper, is in the book. A lot of people from the Hollywood scene. Coyote Shivers, some of you might or might not know him. He's in the book. Just a lot of people. And it was really a fun process. My husband did all the photos. And it was really wild. And again, it all came about, you know, my husband, my dad was like, well, this knitting thing is very interesting, Cher. Sounds like you're really into it. How can you make money from that? Well, Dad, I can have a book.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
Wow. I love that. That's just great. But the whole snobby knitting lady, that's like the highlight.
Oh my God. And you know what? They're everywhere. Like, I tried to go to a knitting store here in Florida and I didn't have that vibe that my friend's store had in LA. So I just was like, forget it, you know?
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Now a hard question. Well, maybe not for you. It's not hard.
Okay.
And we're not going to limit this to a category. We're just going to say this because you are. What superpower do you bring to the table, no matter what it is that you're doing?
Ooh, I love it. I think my superpower is flying. I help people to fly, and I fly. And I see flight as creating lightness of being, moving into joy.
I love it.
No matter what the situation is. And when I don't do that, damn, girl, I know it. I know it. And it sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like I've got lead in my shoes. And I always have to shift myself back out. And then once I shift back out, then I'm like, oh, I'm flying again. This is awesome.
When did you actually become aware of that? Or have you always known it?
I have not always known that. Definitely not always. Probably about pre my husband. I'm thinking, God, okay, I've been married for 19 years plus. So probably about 25 years ago.
Cool. How did you realize it? Was there some life-altering event, or did you just wake up one day and like, oh, yeah, this is what works for me?
There was a little bit of a life-altering event. The other death-defying experience besides the hurricane and the Bermuda Triangle was the time that I drove my Mustang across country, and then on the way back, I was rear-ended by a 18-wheeler semi-truck in the mountains of Arizona in a blizzard.
Oh, no.
Yeah, there's a whole story around it. I'm working on my book right now as well. That involves like spending the night in a tow truck garage where I was waiting for banjos to start playing the Deliverance song.
No.
And the guy shown me his shotgun collection. And oh, geez, it was crazy.
Wow.
Crazy, crazy. So that kind of was a turning point. And even before that, though, I had started just that whole process of the I am thing really shifted me. And as soon as I started to do that, it was like I started sort of leading people in meditation and talking to people about, you know, being themselves and all this. And I started to realize that whenever I was centered, I was able to help other people sort of achieve that centered feeling and then in the process get lighter.
Yeah.
Because heaviness is a reflection of emotions. And, you know, emotions manifest themselves as thoughts because our thoughts have to rationalize how we feel. So for any emotion that you feel, you have thoughts about it. So if you can change those feelings and shift them to a better feeling, to something that feels, you know, oh, that feels way better. You know, I mean, courage is going to feel better than guilt.
Oh, yeah.
You know, acceptance is going to feel better than fear. All that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and then all that stuff just shifts your energy. And as soon as you have that sort of lightness, you really feel like anything is possible.
Absolutely.
That's what it's about. I mean, that is it in a nutshell. It's like, I want to feel like anything and everything is possible 24/7. I have never achieved that. I mean, that would be like enlightenment, I suppose. But, you know, that's the goal. That's the end game, you know, and that's like it, you know. And I think music elevates us to that place a lot of times. That's why we love music. You listen to a song and it can make you feel super hopeful. You know, you can feel understood. You can feel connected and all that good, juicy stuff that's so strong and powerful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So what would you say has been the most mind-blowing experience of your, whether it's music, whether it's coaching, whatever, just like what's that one thing where you're like, oh my God, I can't even believe that that just happened?
That's a good question. Wow, that's a really good question. I think the biggest thing is when you forget who you are, no matter what I'm doing, whether I'm coaching or I'm playing music or rehearsing or singing or swimming or running or whatever, when you just have that moment of just forgetting who you are and you're just there to experience the moment, That's it, man. That's the end all be all.
Oh, that's great. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And I think it's really important to differentiate. Like, I'm not talking about numbing yourself and getting high or getting wasted or getting stoned or whatever, which trust me, I've done my share of running away. And I'm here to say that feeling your stuff, no matter it's good or bad, is so much better. And then that is when you really experience those moments of like, wow, I was just really in the moment right there. And I forgot who I was. I forgot all those old stories, you know? But it's like that awesomeness, like when you're just waking up from the most amazing dream and you don't remember all the crap that you usually remember about yourself. That's awesome. And that's our true infinite potential. At any given moment, we can tap into that.
I love that. I'm having so much fun during this conversation. I just have to throw that out there.
Thank you. You're awesome. I want to know what your end-all, be-all experience has been this far or continues to be. What's the moments for you?
Boy, you know what? Nobody asked me questions. I haven't really thought about that.
Well, I shared what mine was. You share yours.
You know, I think, okay, this might sound kind of crazy, but we were in Hawaii a couple of years ago, and I love sea turtles.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm out snorkeling off the beach. And, you know, when you do that, like, it's like you're in somebody else's world, but you're so focused on your breathing. And so you're just very present because of that, I think. And here comes the sea turtle. And he just swam right up by me. And I'm trying to back up because, you know, like, you're not supposed to touch him. And I'm like, hey. It was like Nemo. You're like, hey, dude.
That's so cool.
That was one of the coolest. That was probably one of the coolest things ever.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. That's my little nerdy nature moment.
No, I love that. I mean, that's one of the reasons we moved to Florida.
For the water?
Yeah. Because we go snorkeling. We just walk into the water, snorkel.
Oh, that'd be so
nice.
There
they are. They're right there. We don't have to take a boat. We don't have to do anything. And we're a mile from the beach. So it's just like not a big deal. But that's that thing of like realizing there's this whole other world and they're just like, hi. Hi.
Yeah. It was this super chill.
So cool.
Yeah. So that was probably one of those moments for me.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that. Yeah. I love that.
What's revving your creative engines right now?
Working on my book is hugely ramping me up right now. I haven't decided on the title. It's either going to be called Rock What You Got.
I love it.
Yeah. You like that?
Yeah, that's good.
It's totally what I've done. I've had moments of, you know, dumping the change jar on the floor in my 30s, you know, Vixen's already happened and I am stone cold broke. Just like, wow, I got nothing. I got no credit. I got nothing. I'm screwed. So going through that, and just figuring out, okay, what do I have? Let's make it work. So that whole, all the stories around just, that's just like an everything story. Rock What You Got. The other working title for it is Rock Shine Be, and sort of, I don't know which title it's going to be. But anyway, I'm hoping that the book will be cool for people. Right now I'm writing it and preventing myself from editing it like crazy. Because it's really easy to go, nobody will want to read that. Oh God, that's boring. Oh, blah, blah. So I'm just like, nope, just write. Just keep writing. So, you know, all these crazy stories are in there about, you know, the tow truck guy and the hurricane, all that stuff.
I can't wait to read it.
Oh, thank you. That's really encouraging. So that's one thing that's really huge for me. My husband and I are working on a new record. That's cool. Really got me pumped up because we have all this stuff that we've been kind of storing up mm-hmm. for about like 8 or 9 years now. So we need to bring that into light. Yeah. What else? Well, Vixen's working on a new record, of course.
Cool.
And I don't know. I've always got stuff I'm doing with my business. That's just like an ongoing evolution.
Oh, yeah.
So it's all good. It's all good. But yeah, those are all the creative things.
So what's the best way for people to stay up with you and what you have going on?
Oh, awesome. They can definitely connect with me on my website, sherross.com. And I have a mailing list on there. And that'll always keep you up to date on what I'm doing. You can also reach out to me on Twitter, which is just at Cher Ross. My friend limit is maxed out on Facebook. So that's probably not the, you know what I mean? I can't be your friend on Facebook. But you can follow me on Facebook. And I post a lot on there, of course. So that's always cool. And I do post a lot on Facebook.
Okay, cool. And then one last thing, because I know we're running over. Okay, sure. on the companion Spotify playlist for your episode, what's got to be on it? What's on your mixtape?
Ooh, I love it. I love that. How many songs can I name?
Whatever you want.
Okay. First and foremost would be, I'm going to name three things. I'm going to name four things that are very different.
Okay.
One's going to be Miles Davis, Kind of Blue.
Oh, nice.
Always sends me into like this amazing space. Number two would be, how weird should I go?
Go for it.
All right. This is pretty weird. When I want to get super creative, and you know what? You're a musician. You're gonna totally understand this. I love Ravi Shankar, Chants of India. And here's why. I can't understand it.
Yeah.
I can't play that. Their scale is 24 notes. They use quarter steps. They use quarter tones. So when I hear that stuff, I am sent into like this whole other world. So that's my go-to when I sit and write or when I just want to sit and be creative. I put that in my earbuds. I listen to the whole record. And
oh,
I'm just like,
great.
I'm goners. So I love Ravi Shankar, Chants of India. I don't know the names of the songs. They're Indian names. So I'm sorry, I can't name a song.
No problem. I'll find some stuff.
All right, cool. On the flip side of like being a little bit more than normal, I have to look up her name. Actually, I can't remember her name. It's in my playlist. Okay, I'm going to name something else while I'm looking for this.
Okay.
I have what I call like a feel-good music list because of what we were saying. You know, I think that music makes us feel a certain way. So one of my favorite ones is Shining Star by Earth, Wind & Fire.
Oh, that's a great one.
It always just like elevates me. Just like, boom, I'm up. And then something that's totally not rock. And probably all my rock fans will kill me. But here I go, embarrassing myself because I don't care. You know what? I think this song is genius. And not just because of the name, All About That Bass.
Oh, yeah.
By Meghan Trainor.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved the song before I read about her. And then when I read about her, I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. She's like super musician and all this stuff. And I was like, wow, that's cool. And I think she played that song on like a ukulele to the guy who produced it. And he was like, oh, yeah, I hear it. And if you analyze music like I do or whatever, and I'm sure you do, you'll hear a whole ton of 50s doo-wop in her music, which is really interesting because she's appealing to a very young generation.
Mm-hmm.
And they're hearing 50s doo-wop in there.
I love it.
So I love that. Yeah, I love All About That Bass. I mean, that's like something way more modern. So that's four. You know, if you want to get into rock, it'd be like, geez, any Led Zeppelin. And I'm there.
Right. I'm with you on that. Cool. Well, we're going to have some fun with this playlist.
Cool.
All right. Thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Jen. You're so upbeat and awesome and fun. And this is great. Thank you so much for having me.
That's all, folks. You can check out the show notes at brassybroad.com. The conversation continues over at the Brassy Broadcast page on Facebook or on Twitter and Instagram at brassybroadjen. And don't forget to check out the playlist for this episode on Spotify. You can find me over there at brassybroadjen. One last thing. If you got a little nugget of value or just enjoyed the conversation, please leave a rating and review over at iTunes. Rumor has it that those ratings and reviews help more people discover the show. Or even better, share it with a friend that you think would dig it. Now be brazen, be bold, and get out in the world and do some good.